live from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on the little berry that has 20 times the vitamin C that's in an orange. It's truly a superfood. Also, how America is making the whole world fat and unhealthy. Then, for all the people in this audience, especially people who know women who are pregnant and who are encouraged to take the vaccine, the flu vaccine, if they're pregnant, because it will help protect the mother and the developing fetus, the science behind it, we're challenging. Dr. Susan Jeffries will be challenging this on the program. Also, people have asked me, gee whiz, why aren't you promoting people watching this documentary from the Invisible Children Fund? Because I took the time to do a little research. The documentary is certainly interesting, and it tells a very important story. But I also see a lot in it that I could challenge, and others as well. Did you know that the Invisible Child is funded by an anti-gay creationist Christian right who are using it as a recruiting tool, and that much of the information in the film is years and years out of date? They would have you believe that this tyrant, the individual that they have made the focus of their film, who truly is a war criminal and should be tried with all the vigor that we can, but he hasn't been in Uganda for a long time. So why aren't we focused on the reality? So we'll get to that if time permits. Also, according to the latest information today from the Homeland Security Newswire, surveillance FBI seeks systems to monitor your social networking sites. In other words, the FBI is monitoring every conversation on social networks like Facebook and Twitter. And they recently placed a request for information from technology companies to develop a system capable of automatically sifting through the torrents of publicly available data for keywords relating to what interests them about national security. And the FBI is the latest in a long line of federal agencies seeking to monitor your conversations on social networks. Why should we be concerned about this? Because I believe that we are in a police state. I believe that the average person is unfortunately choosing not to be aware of this, but we are, and we'll take a look at it. And also, we will hear from Shepard Smith and Judge Napolitano to give you their perspective, especially Judge Napolitano's perspective on this. And I was happy to see that Shepard Smith actually became concerned enough that he expressed something that is rare for reporters and broadcasters, some real passion on the issue. We'll deal with this also. The not just creeping, but galloping totalitarianism that's now infiltrated in our various institutions. Our guest in the next 25 minutes will be Dr. Dale Archer. He is a board-certified psychiatrist, and he is a fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and the Institute for Neuropsychiatry. I'm going to offer him some challenges on the mental disorders, or the supposed diagnostics of mental disorders, and I'd like for him to share with us what he can prove is the legitimacy of all these diagnoses. I believe they're all illegitimate. I believe there's no actual science. I've just completed a major 700-page book and a major documentary. I haven't talked about it because it won't be out for a while because I have so many other things in the pipeline. But I'm very concerned that Americans are entering a phase where we're going to be required, especially starting with the children, they have to go through mental health screening. The mental health screening has been designed by the American Psychiatric Association. Every human being could end up being diagnosed with some form of mental disturbance and hence fall into a category of requiring medication or treatment, all of which they profit from, none of which, however, is legitimate. And yet there is no movement to push back. To the contrary, I've heard programs on the left actually encouraging people to get their mandatory vaccine and, you know, that a teen screen's a good thing. Where is the truth? It is lost when these people become advocates before they do their homework. We'll explore that with my guest. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. But first off, some of you should know that you can now listen to this program every day over the telephone. Let me give you this number. Now, I realize a lot of people listening either don't like using computers or don't know how to use them or don't have access to one. But you all have access to a telephone. So now you can call this number and listen to this program. 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. That's a nice service. Some of you have heard of AMLA, A-M-L-A. It's a berry. And this is according to PubMed.gov. Quote, Ayurvedic medicines, including AMLA, reduce blood cholesterol-induced atherosclerosis in rabbits. This is from the International Journal of Cardiology. And then another one here, influence of AMLA on hypercholesteremia and lipid peroxidation in cholesterol-fed rats, Journal of Nutritional Science and Vitaminology, and a lot of other studies. What does this mean? It means that this little berry, the AMLA berry, by the way, you could also know it by another name, Indian gooseberry. They're tart. They're light green to yellow fruit, but it's primarily an Ayurvedic traditions. It was known as a sacred fruit, which heals both the physical and the emotional heart. And scientists have confirmed the benefits of AMLA berries as an antioxidant due to the fact that AMLA berries are a source of vitamin C in the form of ascorbic acid, very rich in polyphenols and flavonoids. They actually contain up to 30 times the vitamin C per pound as does an orange, which makes AMLA berries an extremely effective superfood. It's known for cleansing the liver, high blood cholesterol lowering it. Age-related kidney conditions are improved. And you can get it as a powder, and you can get it as a berry. And so look at your vitamin C. Does it contain AMLA? Some of it does. So that's been there a long time, and a lot of people just didn't know how good it was for them, and now mainstream science is catching up to what Ayurvedic has known for centuries. More children, according to the University of Leeds, are now living with life-limiting conditions. Let me quote this. It says, from the peer-reviewed journal Pediatrics, the number of children with conditions such as muscular dystrophy, neurodegenerative disorders, or severe cerebral palsy who are surviving into adulthood has been underestimated. The study, which was published in the journal, shows that children are ending up sicker than ever before. Now, why? They don't tell why. They just tell that this is the phenomena. Well, that goes to the other concept that we're seeing, and that is that America is leading the world in bad food habits. Recently, I was in Harlem. I wanted to do an update on research I'd done 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I went up to 125th Street, and I went from one end of the 125th to the other end. And in that area, I found some fast food restaurants and a healthy food restaurant, in fact, two. And the healthy food restaurant had long lines of people wanting their healthy food and juices. And the fast food restaurant had long lines wanting their junk food. The interesting thing was I found many of the listeners from this audience who identified themselves as listening to the show who were at the unhealthy place. People develop certain taste or how they feel when they've had a particular food like chocolate or sugar, and it almost becomes an addictive substance to them. They then want that. People like French fries, and they like the crunch, the salty flavor, but not just any French fry. There are certain French fries they really enjoy, and others they don't. And, in fact, McDonald's perfected how they can actually make a French fry that has a certain moisture content, a certain crunchy quality, a certain look, and a certain mouthfeel. But they're not healthy. So what happens when you develop a taste for unhealthy items? Sooner or later, you pay a price, but it'll be later in most cases. But it depends upon how many bad things you're doing. When I was growing up, we drank Kool-Aid. You know, all kids did. In fact, we had a little Kool-Aid stands, and we'd sell for a nickel, you know, a little cup of Kool-Aid or lemonade. But when we sat down to a meal, our family ate together, and more often than not, the food that our family gave us was healthy food, especially if you came from the country, because then you knew how to get fresh produce or even dried produce. I remember my first experience watching my great aunt dry string beans and tomatoes and squash on screens. It looked like a screen door that then had that cheesecloth on top of it to keep the flies and insects off. And after 4 days, they were nice and crisp. The moisture had been evaporated, but the nutrients were still there. And I said, what do you do with this? And she said, well, in the wintertime, when I can't grow something like a tomato, I go in and get the dried tomatoes, and then I can add them into any item with water, like a stew, and they plump up and they rehydrate. I'd never known that. And yet it would take another 30 years before dried foods became popular. Right now, dried kale, raw kale that's dried at about 110 degrees and then seasoning put on it, is one of the hottest things in the health food store. It's a healthy product. There's nothing wrong with it. It's actually good for you. And it's, and to the person who created that, good for them. Now there are about 100 knockoffs of it. Now someone will go from dried kale. I'm sure you'll find dried string beans with different flavors and dried spinach, etc. But it starts with one. Everything starts with one good idea upon which everyone else expands. But what happens when you have one or two not healthy items, but the rest of your diet's healthy, and then you supplement and then you exercise? More often than not, the body can compensate. You know, so you're not going to drop over dead. But as times have changed, it's just the opposite. You're lucky if you sit with your family for a meal. You're lucky if you have a chance to put away the cell phones, turn off radio and television, be undistracted with that conversation, and that you have healthy food. More often than not, people order in, and what are they ordering? All unhealthy foods. Nobody orders in healthy foods because there's no money in it. They can't be stored and frozen and thawed and mass-produced. It takes time and effort to put them together. It's just not cost-effective. In a fast-food restaurant, you might find some salad material, but that's not what people go. Nobody goes to a McDonald's to buy their salad. You go to buy their McMuffins and other food. Now we've exported that around the world. Now there are people growing up who think that a good meal is one that just satisfies your appetite and your preferences for taste and mouthfeel and nothing else. If it's inexpensive, people say, well, I don't have a lot of money, so, you know, this is what I can afford. This is a comment from Joanne Richardson from Alternet. How America is making the whole world fat and unhealthy. And I'll just quote the first page. It is hardly news that the United States faces an epidemic of health problems linked to poor diets. Nearly 2 out of every 5 Americans are obese. But according to a press release from the UN Special Administrator on Right to Food, quote, the West is now exporting diabetes and heart disease to developing countries along with processed foods that line the shelves of global supermarkets. In the near future, 5 million people will die each year before the age of 60 from non-communicable diseases linked to their diets, end quote. Well, there was a doctor, Shooter, whose work usually focused on ending hunger, just published a new report saying, quote, the right to food cannot be reduced to a right not to starve. It is an inclusive right to an adequate diet providing all the nutritional elements of an individual requires to live a healthy and active life and the means to access them. In other words, the right to a healthy diet must be included in the human right to food. And as the unhealthy diets already common in the United States spread to poorer nations, so do the health problems associated with those diets. However, unlike wealthy nations, poor nations are not equipped to deal with the health consequences like medicine, making preventable diet-related health problems more deadly. While the poor around the world face hunger, for those who have enough to eat in non-industrialized nations, traditional diets are very healthy. In Kenya, for example, peasant farmers subsist on a stiff corn porridge called ugali, eaten with a variety of green vegetables and beans and pumpkin. Peasants in Bolivia dine on potatoes, quinoa, and other grains, corn, sweet potatoes, and other Andean roots and tubers. Mexicans combine corn tortillas and beans to provide complete protein. And a Filipino family may eat a pinkabet, a stew of local vegetables flavored with bagung, a Filipino fish sauce. In each and every case, the traditional diets are made up of whole foods, including grains, beans, vegetables, fresh fruit, and perhaps some animal protein occasionally. Wild plants that an American might dispose of as weeds are used to provide essential micronutrients, feed families during hard times, and serve as medicines. Often, fermentation is used to preserve foods and increase their nutrition, as in the case of Kenya's fermented porridge, ugali. Livestock enjoy diverse natural diets, and that's what it is. But times are changing. Visit even the most far-flung rural parts of each of these nations today, and you'll find Coca-Cola advertising and Coca-Cola everywhere. Restaurants and stores in Africa display Coca-Cola-themed store signs, while their menus are posted on Coca-Cola chalkboards, and waiters wear red Coca-Cola aprons. In South America, you can buy a bottle of Coke out of your car window from a vendor dressed in red Coca-Cola-themed gear while you wait in traffic. If there is anywhere on Earth you cannot easily buy an ice-cold Coke, it's Antarctica, although it's very possible that there are already shops selling ice-cold Coke there, too. And while other junk foods are sold in each of these places may not be such recognizable global brands, they are equally detrimental to human health no matter which company makes them or how they're branded. In fact, in this report, Dr. Shooter gives Mexico a particular example. Mexico, only second to the United States in the percentage of its population now obese, once had a national diet that dietitians considered nearly perfect. In a 1967 book called Campaigns Against Hunger, scientists wrote, quote, "It appears that the Mexican Indians, living on the land and eating their corn, beans, and chili peppers, supplemented with tomatoes and seeds and the flesh of squashes and wild plants, may have had not just an adequate diet, but a near-perfect one," end quote. Well, what happened? What happened is simple. NAFTA, quote, this is from Peter Brown, an activist with the nonprofit schools, for Chapatas, quote, "Shortly after the passage of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in 1994, and by 2010 began to observing diabetes in the population he worked with, a problem the communities had never had before. Dr. Shooter connects the dots, noting that the massive investment in the Mexican food processing industry by U.S. companies followed NAFTA and the subsequent rise in the sales of processed food at a rate of 10% annually between 1995 and 2003. It's not unheard of for parents to feed young children soda from a baby bottle in Mexico these days." And then he goes into a concise history of how they had a healthy diet with very good health in Mexico, and after NAFTA, they ended up with unhealthy diet. And so when we think about these free trade agreements, which we should not have, and because they're purely a globalization strategy that does not help the poor. I remember when I was down in Jamaica, and I happen to think Jamaica is one of the most beautiful islands in the world, and the Jamaican people are uniquely wonderful human beings. They're very warm, very hospitable. And I noticed how thin they were, and I asked, and I was invited into different homes when I went down there to do research, and they would go out in your backyard. In backyards, sometimes on the side of hills, you would see 20 to 30 different things growing. You'd have beans growing and mangoes and bananas and papaya and watermelons. And you'd have garlic and onions and potatoes all growing in a patch behind their house. And because they have 12 months a year growing season, and because their soil is volcanic and so rich, and because these people understood natural farming, large swaths of land throughout the Central Valley, which is really neat if you've never seen it. You come down off a mountain, and suddenly in front of you is this gigantic savanna. It goes on as far as the eye can see. It's probably, oh, I'm going to guess, 5 to 10 miles wide and maybe 30 to 50 miles long. And it used to be that it was broken up into small farms, and the people traded amongst each other. And then in came the treaties, and then in came Bill Clinton's guys, and suddenly genetic engineering and subsidizing American farmers to sell their products under these treaties in Jamaica. And now, one by one, every one of those farms collapsed. And then their farmland was taken over and genetically engineered single crops grew where there had been 100 different variety of crops. So we used to be able to go to a local market and get your milk that was fresh milked and healthy milk. Now you went to a place and you got reconstituted milk where you add water to it. Well, the reconstituted milk that gave you a gallon of milk was half the price of locally produced milk. And you would see trucks come in, and these would be trucks where Idaho potatoes. So now the people went out and they could buy a bag, a 25-pound bag of Idaho, United States potatoes for half the price of a locally grown organic potato. And unfortunately, when people are stressed financially or they think they're getting a good bargain, they don't know about genetic engineering. They didn't at that time. They didn't know that the more of these crops you're buying from America where the farmers are subsidized or their major agri corporations doing this, you're putting all of these local farmers out of business. All the local farmers are going to go under, and that's exactly what's happened to Jamaica. So now you have massive poverty in Jamaica, massive poverty. And unless you get a government in there that's going to bring back the land, because there's plenty of land, plenty of knowledge. But for the last 25 years, Jamaica has gone through what happens with globalization. And it's terrible on all levels. So what is the takeaway message here? The takeaway message is that the United States supports globalization, NAFTA, GATT, CAFTA, the World Trade Organization, all of which we should withdraw from and all of which should be abolished. They're all criminal and they're all corrupt. B, don't buy something if it's not organic. Even today, even in my office, before I came down to the show, a gentleman who wants me to counsel one of his friends this Friday, right before a lecture I'm doing, I said, all right. And he said, I'm going to get an apple downstairs. I said, that's genetically engineered and heavily pesticide sprayed. At a vendor on the street corner, I said, just walk a couple blocks in any direction, buy an organic apple. And he said, oh, I'm hungry. I said, think of what you're saying. You're a person who calls yourself progressive, independent thinking, and yet where you would have every legitimate argument not to buy something sprayed with a pesticide or herbicide or fungicide, and not to be genetically engineered, you're doing exactly that. So which is it? Do you have the strength just to walk an extra block to get an organic apple, or are you going to buy a genetically engineered apple? So we have to not just talk it, we have to walk it. We have to be the philosophy that we espouse to others and that we believe is important. So don't shop anymore at Walmart's. Don't shop go down to Chinatown or go someplace to meet with a homeopath, a naturopath, a holistic clinician, an herbalist, and look at the remedies they have for most conditions that are not based upon emergency medicine, instead of just taking whatever your orthodox doctor tells you, which more often than not is overprescribed, overdiagnosed, and not good. And then take a look at the amount of food that we're eating, far more than what we need, even if it's healthy. And then look at what we eat as a country and what we export, and then ask yourself, how likely is it that the American public is going to change their consciousness about the fact that the food is their poison and they're killing themselves with non-communicable preventable diseases? The answer is, it's not going to happen. Not in your lifetime. Not my lifetime. Why? Because information and facts never change people. If they did, selecting the best information and facts would have changed our nation on every level, and we would have a representative republic instead of a completely corrupt, paid-for democracy, which is a pseudo-faux democracy. We wouldn't have obesity in children and diabetes. We wouldn't be suffering from all the mental decline, memory loss, and dementia, because we wouldn't be doing what creates the plaque, the beta plaque, the amyloid plaque, that creates the blocking and destruction of neurons. So then how do we get beyond this? We don't. Where's the happy ending? There is none. How do we take back our democracy through reform and voting for the right person? We can't. Is that negative? Absolutely not. It is pragmatic and honest. I do not see anything changing anywhere. I don't see this station changing. No matter how much they need to, and if they don't, they will not survive another year or two. I don't see any change. So wise people can't communicate, can't change, and if they can't change, how are they going to change the institution they're part of? How are the institutions going to change when bloated bureaucracies are all that run our government and our country today? How's medicine going to change when it refuses to acknowledge its own complicity in causing diseases and death by what it gives people? How can anything change when there's a profit basis and commodification basis? No one wants to give up the profit and put themselves out of business. How can anything change when nobody wants to admit what they've done is wrong and not in the public interest? I haven't seen any change in my lifetime, and I won't. But here's the other side of that argument. I see massive change, all positive, for those who are independent enough and have broken free from the dark side of their conditioned self to ask themselves, what do I want for myself, for my family, for my country, for my neighbor? I want health and happiness. I want a clean environment. I want to support a living wage. I want to support nature. In which case, what choices must I make? Then you won't be eating the genetically engineered apple because it's convenient, nor the hot dog or hamburger or french fries because it's crunchy or soft or it gives you the right mouthfeel or after effect. You'll be taking the extra effort because you want the best results. You'll get off the grid in a reasonable and responsible way. You'll look for all the alternatives. You'll buy American. You'll go green, authentically green, not faux green. You'll stop supporting all the environmental organizations and start supporting small grassroots efforts. Those are the ones who ultimately have not sold out and compromised, and I'll be doing a special show on that. You'll start communicating with people without Twitter. I have yet to Twitter, and I won't. If someone wants to talk to me, look me in the eyes and talk with me. All right? I'm not going to dumb down for the sake of what is convenient. We have to get over what is convenient and challenge what is convenient with what is needed. People may not like what they hear at times or see at times, but if that's what we need to change, then let that be the catalyst of change. If it causes rage, if it causes pain, if it causes angst, but on the other side of that is a new self emerging into an enlightened state of being that is going to be empowered, then that is pain worth suffering through. But we don't have to suffer in order to grow. It's a choice. Yes, you have a choice if you want to suffer. Health is easy. Happiness is easy. Honesty is easy. When you're honest, you're happy, you're healthy, you're giving, you're sharing, you're caring, you don't have to go to bed at night apologizing for anything you've done, said, manipulation, lying, conniving, greed, in order to enhance yourself at the cost of someone else. So show me where it's difficult to change. It is not. It is not authentic change. It's difficult ever. Show me a politician that should fear sticking with principles, not compromising on them, for the common good. There's no difficulty in that. The difficulty is in what you fear losing. The other side of that is, if I change, how can I go back to my comfort? You can't. So we stop short of authentic change. We tease ourselves. We tease ourselves by watching people like Oprah and the others of her ilk who have been the opium for the masses, people who want to pretend that they're changing but not, well, who want to have a big hug and cry together and pretend that the newest secret, the newest author, the newest Harpo production is the answer to our problems. Let's just get glued in to it, gorilla glued so we're attached to the hip, and have one big ooh-ah-ah. But what changes? Nothing. We have to stop looking for gurus and priests of insight that we refuse to accept that we are capable of ourselves. We fear loss of what was familiar and predictable and easy, even if it was something as simple as smoking a cigarette or drinking coffee or socializing with alcohol, because it was hardwired that this was okay because everyone else is doing it. It's okay until you get your heart attack and stroke, until you're diagnosed with obesity or diabetes, or until you've lost your memory. Then you find comfort in the fact that there are so many other tens of millions of people who are just like you. Well, that doesn't change the reality of what should have been a moment of transformation. I don't want to tell you that things are going to get better for the average person. They are not. That our society is going to turn around after a cataclysmic event. We will not. That we will have more enlightened people coming to the fore, whether it's in social organizations or in federal agencies. We will not. That there are leaders out there who are motivated by a spiritual desire to connect all people and seek peaceful solutions. We do not. We have a nation run by selfishness, sloth, greed, eagerness, and anticipation of our next joyful ride on that roller coaster of passion and pleasure as a passive spectator to our own existence. That's unfortunate. The truth is that nothing in life is predictable, and we cannot control the outcome of other people's reactions to us or even the environment we live in. What we can control is how we choose to position ourselves. If we want a happy life, a healthy life, then we have to choose everything that would help us support that. If you do that, then there's some reasonable expectation that you can be happier and healthier and more balanced, more objective than you otherwise would have been. To abrogate that, because it's just too difficult to think for yourself, you've got to have re-encouragement from the media gossip, the wags and hags and sags of the Bill O'Reillys and the Sean Hannitys on the right and the Keith Urbans and Rachel Maddow and the others on the left, as if somehow these ideologies promoted by these ideologues are the certainties we need to get the right place at the right time. How many of these people are healthy? How many are happy? How many of them are giving? When was the last time you saw any of these dilettantes without media coverage going into the slums and helping? When was the last time you saw them going out to personally, one-on-one, find the problems and solve them to the degree they could in that moment of that day? Not as a token by giving some guy on the street, you know, a dollar and thinking, well, I did my thing, but making that a part of your life. We do not see that in any of them, because their own self-interest comes first and foremost. But when you come from an enlightened, mindful side, where your spiritual self is what is guiding you, then it is not only easy to do that each day, to care for others as you would yourself, but it is a part and parcel of your authentic self. And everything else is a conditioned reflection of how well we are at adapting or maladapting to the world we live in and the condition we've had up to that moment. So look at the red meat on your plate and ask yourself, as one of the most popular television programs, can that guy get 6 pounds of meat in their body and get the applause of people? And what message does that serve to people who think, well, gee whiz, maybe I could do that? And what happens when we ask people to be vegan instead of red meat carnivores? It's a tough call, isn't it? It means we have to transcend our conditioning. And therein is the pain. Being a vegan is easy. Being a meat eater is easy, even when you know that you have indigestion, when you have a higher risk of colorectal cancer, when you have a higher risk of blood pressure, and when you're doing harm to the environment and slaughtering an innocent animal. If you use logic, you'd say, do you want that burger? I do. Then why not make a cat burger or dog burger out of your cat or your dog? Oh, well, that's different. Is it? Have you ever befriended a calf that will grow up to be your burger? No. Do that, and then tell me if it's as easy to eat a friend or a pet as it is to eat something that's strange, that you removed yourself from responsibility. I think it's time that as a nation we begin to look deeper at issues than the body politic. The left, with its conceit, its arrogance, and its capacity for self-destruction, getting a bunch of people from the left into a room and giving them forks, I can assure you there won't be an eye that's not poked out within an hour. There is no sense of the spirit because the reality has locked into a political dynamic. Where is the spiritual awakening in the body politic? Right now it doesn't exist and it has not existed since Martin Luther King in America and Gandhi in India said, bring the spiritual to the political. And we can't even bring the spiritual to our own children. As a result, we feed them to death. We have an epidemic of adult diabetes in children and obesity in children and heart disease in children and arthritis in children and inflammation in children. And where is it written that we have no capacity to make reasonable and responsible choices in our lives? I believe we can, and I believe for those who are open to that change, they will find a whole new life ahead. Are we all going there together? No, we are not. Is the vast majority of Americans going to change anything? Will they be more conscious of the environment and stop polluting? No, they will not. Will they be wiser in the next election? Absolutely not. Will they take time to watch what goes in their food and see whether or not the food is right to eat, genetically engineered or processed? Will they take time to see how much food their body needs and what types to nourish it at its ultimate level? No, they will not. And we will have books that we will not read because we're too busy with our lives. And occasionally when we feel such guilt, we'll go off with Tony Robbins and all sing and dance and clap our hands and give him $70,000 and feel good about ourselves for a moment. Commercial spiritualism. And before Tony, there was Deepak, and there's always someone willing to take away our pain, assuage our conviction that maybe we should be doing better if we're so successful. But success does not inherently conform a sense of inner wisdom. Knowledge is just an accumulation of facts. I'm Gary Nall. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And finally, just to put a dot on this, is the American Heart Association, quote, as published in the peer-reviewed journal Circulation, men who drank a 12-ounce, a single 12-ounce sugar-sweetened beverage a day had a 20% higher risk of heart disease compared to men who did not drink that drink. So what does this mean? With this compounding scientific proof that what we're doing is wrong with these sugar beverage juices, will this change us? Not at all. We've had 553,000 studies in peer-reviewed literature showing what we should be doing right, and yet we do not do it. The physicians, the nurses, the public health officials, the head of the AMA, the head of the FDA, the head of the CDC, the head of the U.S. Public Health Service, who should be those who are preventing disease, are not. But they're all there with the prescription in case you get sick. Back in a moment with my guest and your thoughts. 888-874-4888. Welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Nall. My guest, Dr. Dale Archer, medical doctor, board-certified psychiatrist, distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, and founder of the Institute for Neuropsychiatry in Lake Charles, Louisiana, will be my guest. He is the author of Better Than Normal, How What Makes You Different Can Make You Exceptional. We'll go to him in just a moment. Let me just say thank you to all the people who showed up last night at the premiere in New York of American Veterans Discarded and Forgotten. And afterwards, I spent about an hour and a half there with people in a Q&A, and plus they were giving comments and feedback. The largest responses as a group that I received was that people simply were not aware that we had a million homeless vets and that we had so many who were suffering and that the government and the American people were not helping them, including the fact that time after time we showed example of how church members who went out to a group of homeless people to feed them a meal were arrested because you're not allowed to feed homeless people in a public park in Orlando, and how homeless vets sitting on a veteran's bench in a veteran's park were arrested because, though being poor is not a crime, being a homeless vet is in the state of Florida. And how many go to prison? One guy went to jail because the light on his bike was not working. And another time, he was sent to jail because there was a flooding and he walked beside the pool of water off the sidewalk, and the cop said, you should be on the sidewalk, and that was all it took. Had he been a regular citizen, nothing would have happened. So much for our being a nation that cares about our vets. Anyhow, it's a sobering look. I put the trailer, including people's comments today, after they watched it, up on my television, and I'll tell you where you can look at that and see for yourself. GaryNull.tv, GaryNull.tv. Watch the trailer and then look at the people's response who came out of the theater from all walks of life. It's not the easiest thing to watch, but I'm a believer that you've got to walk towards our problems, towards our crisis, not away from them. Anyhow, the film is American Veterans, Discarded and Forgotten, and now I'll start a program to try to help as many vets as we can by organizing them and getting this information. What can you do? Get the information to the media. We have a lot of vets willing to be the spokespersons for other vets from the Vietnam War, the Korean War, and the Iraq and Afghanistan War. They don't need me to be their spokesperson. They're more than capable of articulating what it is to be a vet and not decommissioned from the war mindset that you're in, and you come home and try to associate with your family. Not easy to do. So let them tell their story. I'm merely the one who put their story together so we knew how bad it is, and it's an unflinching look at what it is. Now, let's go over and say hello to Dr. Dale Archer. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Archer.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Dr. Archer, before we move into the particular strengths behind several common mental disorder diagnoses, I would like to first query you about the state of psychiatry today as a medical science. Recently, there was a study published that showed that as low as 15% of psychiatrists do any kind of talk therapy or psychotherapy. Instead, psychiatrists are increasingly relying on drug prescriptions after a diagnosis that pretty much characterizes a great deal of the general psychiatric profession today, and there have been commentaries showing that there is no real incentive for psychiatrists to spend quality time and hours doing talk therapy, since many insurers will not cover prescriptions, not the talk therapy. So I would like to first hear your critique of this growing trend of solely relying upon drugs to treat mental disturbances, because obviously with that, we are having a lot of people who are now on these drugs with some very serious side effects. Your thoughts, please.
Well, that's exactly what I talk about in my book. And, you know, I think the biggest problem right now is the fact that back in 1987, when I graduated from my residency from the University of Texas, we got about 50% of our training in psychotherapy and about 50% in medication and biologic psychiatry. The psychiatrists that are graduating today get virtually no psychotherapy training whatsoever. So not only don't they get paid to do it, they don't know how to do it. In fact, we're bringing in a couple of psychiatrists this year who received zero training in psychotherapy. So unfortunately, it's become a very medication-dominated profession. And, you know, for a lot of that, the psychiatrists themselves have to look within and blame themselves. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for it, but I think that the field is probably as much to blame as the insurance companies, as the pharmaceutical companies, and, you know, even as the general public, because in our pop a pill, feel good, I want to feel good now culture, people don't want to take the time to do psychotherapy. They want that pill to feel better right away.
Okay, I appreciate that insight. I'm having a strong issue about the American Psychiatric Association's selected, hand-selected group of individuals who, by vote, with no science to back them up, have the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, number 5, coming out, where myself or anyone like me who cares about your health would now be considered to have a psychiatric disorder. They also, and I'd like you to address this, they have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, meaning being adventurous. That's one of the diagnoses. In other words, the symptoms. If you're adventurous, you can fall into that. If you're a perfectionist, then it's obsessive compulsive disorders. If you're shy, it's social anxiety disorder. If you're hyper alert, you have general anxiety disorder. If you're dramatic, as many people are in their natural personalities, it is a histrionic disorder. If you're self-focused and aware of your own strength, it's a narcissistic disorder. If you have high energy, it's bipolar. If you're creative and magical, it's schizophrenia. So I'd like for you to explain to us how we can make the normal conditions that people go through at different times in life all now mental disorders, and insist that these people's conditions are real biological problems, that medication is the only source of helping them.
Well, mental health problems don't come with an on-off switch. And that's the biggest problem with the DSMs, and the DSM-5, by all accounts, is going to be no different. And if you meet 5 of 8 criteria, you're OCD. If you meet 4 of 8, you're not. So these conditions occur along a continuum. And, you know, there's a little bit of movement with the bipolar diagnosis, because now we have 3 disorders, cyclothymic, bipolar 2, and bipolar 1 for mild, medium, and severe bipolar. But even that is missing the point that these diagnoses and conditions occur along a continuum, but it's not from you reach point B and you fall off a cliff and you have the disorder. Every single one of us has these traits, some more, some less. So if you have bipolar 9-10, OCD 9-10, ADHD a 9 or a 10, and this is on a scale of 1 to 10, yeah, you probably have a real condition and you may need to be treated with medication. But the vast majority of people are getting diagnosed with 5, 6, 7, and 8 rankings on a scale of 1 to 10. So if it's hyperdominant, if your trait is hyperdominant, yeah, you probably need treatment. But unfortunately, it's become the point where if anyone walks in now to a psychiatrist's office, or heck, even a family practitioner's office, and says, I'm feeling a little depressed, they don't get any type of analysis. They get an antidepressant. I'm a little anxious. They get an anti-anxiety pill. I'm shy. Oh, you have social anxiety. You need to be treated. No one is sitting them down and saying, yeah, you know what? You do have some shy symptoms. But instead of being the outgoing life of the party, which this pill can help you do, why don't we talk about what's good about being shy? Why don't we talk about what's good about being a 7 on the OCD continuum? Why don't we talk about magical thinking and the fact that, you know what, it's not disrupting the way you live your life, so this has tremendous strength, but no one talks about that. You either have the condition or you don't, and if you have it, you get treated, by and large, with a medication, and everyone else is wondering, well, you know what, I mean, he did a lot better with his anxiety, and I'm going to go get a pill for that. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, I would challenge this concept completely, because I've seen the people who've gotten off the psych meds and then they were allowing their own natural feelings, their inclinations, their response levels to things to be examined in a different context. In other words, what happens in life when you have grief, when you've had a loss of something? It's normal to go through a period of mourning. To suggest that we all should have a particular way of dealing with grief or loss or crisis in our marriage or crisis in our relationship or crisis in our health care, that's the problem, because we're expected all to be the same, and if we're not, then so there's something that has to be diagnosable in that. So therefore, oh, this person's better now because they're more normal. Is that to assume that normal is like everyone else? Look at all the kids today who go to school, and they're all very hyper. Did anyone ever look to see how much caffeine they're consuming, what their diet is, whether they're doing any meditation or not, how much time they spend on a cell phone, what the cell phone does to the chromosomes in the brain? We're not looking at the total picture at all with people, but it's real quick and easy for someone to be given a diagnosis, be put on a pill, and then they don't act out. Ah, is that what we're achieving? An emotionally lobotomized society where no one acts out? Sir, if we accept that this is a legitimate way to be, you will never again have a preacher, a minister, an evangelical approach. You will have no longer people with enthusiasm to speak. You will no longer have activists. You will no longer have innovation. And you sure as hell won't have another artist being able to express himself. All of that comes when we all get normalized by the meds. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, you know, Webster's dictionary defines normal, interestingly enough, as free from a mental disorder. So the field of psychiatry has taken on the mantra of defining what normal is. And that's a huge problem. Essentially, 30 years ago when I started practicing, no one wanted to see a shrink. They were told, you know, be strong, get over it, you're going to be fine. You don't have to go get on a pill. You don't have to need therapy. You can do it yourself. There was an incredible stigma about going to see a psychiatrist. As we've broken that down over the years, and of course, people with really severe problems, they do need to get help. But what's happened is we've swung the pendulum from where no one wanted to see a psychiatrist to now psychiatry has gone from being stigmatized to glamorized. And everyone wants to go see a psychiatrist and get a medication. And psychiatry has basically taken the normal box, which 30 years ago was a big, giant box and a lot of different quirks and creativity and all kinds of people were able to fit in this big box called normal, and they've shrunk it down smaller and smaller and smaller. In 1952, when the first DSM-1 came out, there were 106 psychiatric diagnoses. When the DSM-4 revised came out in 2000, there were 356 diagnoses. So in a span of 40 years, we've added 250 mental disorders. It's crazy. The National Institute of Mental Health did a study a couple of years ago that found that 26% of Americans had a diagnosable psychiatric illness. That's one in four. That's ridiculous. I mean, the standards now and the normal box has gotten so small that virtually everyone is encompassed in the abnormal universe, and therefore everyone needs to be treated. And that's the problem that we're facing as the pendulum continues to swing further.
It is only a problem for those people like yourself who have some ethics to apply to the treatment of patients, to the patients. 30 years ago, before we became focused on using a pharmacological approach to our mental conditions, there was no registration anywhere I could find the vital statistics of teenagers taking their lives. Today, it's the number one cause of suicide in 10 to 14-year-old boys, suicide. That is the byproduct. Also, we have to understand that you will not have a diagnosis today of a new condition unless there's a drug to treat it. So why can't we be honest and pull back the curtain and see behind that the Wizard of Oz are the pharmaceutical companies giving us drugs that have now been shown to be no better than a placebo, but a placebo won't kill you. It's our belief in the treatment or the person offering the treatment. And if it's based upon the belief in the person, I would rather have a holistic psychiatrist, an orthomolecular psychiatrist, a holistic psychologist like Dr. Grayson or others, Dr. Shoshona, who may help us, may not, but they're not going to hurt us, and leave only a pharmacological approach to the very last stage of helping a person. Your final thoughts.
Well, I totally agree with you, and I think that's the problem that we're facing now. The meds do work in very severe cases, but they should indeed be the last, literally the last ditch effort when everything else has failed. You know, it's a multifactorial problem that we're facing. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry, of course, makes billions of dollars. And then you've got the insurance companies who won't pay for the talk therapy anyway because they know it's cheaper to be able to take a pill and have medication management visits versus actual psychotherapy. The psychiatrists have long wanted to feel like they were real doctors in a hard medical specialty, so they're embracing the fact that all of a sudden they have all of these different medications that can treat virtually every condition that you can name. And then finally, the patients themselves, who have been swayed by the marketing that's going on in this country, come to believe that they want to be like everyone else. They want to be quote-unquote normal, and of course when you analyze it, normal means average, and if you try to please everyone and conform to the norm, you're going to lose your uniqueness, which is the foundation for your greatness.
Very good insight there. My final statement is that there's a new law about to be passed that the FDA is supporting that would allow a lot of medications to be gotten without a doctor's prescription. hence bypassing the physician, bypassing the prescription and being able to get them. Now they're registered, so a doctor would have to see you. There would be some measure of control, and that is the scary future. That's how much power the pharmaceutical industry has over our legislative process. That's the next thing coming up, and it'll be up within the next 6 months to a year. You could get your drugs, serious drugs, without a prescription, without seeing a doctor. That's being advocated as we speak. Doctor, thank you very much. Hopefully your book will enlighten people better than normal. How what makes you different can make you exceptional. Website drdalearcher.com. Thank you, Dr. Archer.
Thank you, Gary. Appreciate it.
I'm Gary Nall. For those of you who just listened to part of our program, we thank you for doing that. For those who want to now hear our questions and answers, some people in the audience, you can go to our network and listen over the Internet or call 832-280-0066. Let's say hello to Jeanette from, I believe, is it San Francisco?
Yes, hi.
Hi, Jeanette.
I'm in the Bronx right now. I was at the 311 commemoration the other day, and we found out that a lot of very toxic radiated material will start sweeping up on all of the coasts of the country very soon, and radioactive fallout has already been detected, you know, within 100 miles of both coasts and clear across the United States. I remember a few months ago you gave us some tips and pointers as to how we could protect ourselves from the excessive radioactive fallout, protect our health with homeopathic and herbal and other nutritive ways. And unfortunately, you were talking so fast, I was trying to write things down. But
okay, do this. It's all in the archive. Go to the archive, progressiveradionetwork.com, the archive. Just type in either the date or the topic or the guest, and that entire show is there to re-listen to, and all of the different solutions to help us are there in detail. Thank you. And Elizabeth in studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. I just want to say that I was there at the screening yesterday with many, many people. It was absolutely packed. This is a screening for your latest film, Veterans Discarded and Forgotten. It was a brilliant film. Myself and a lot of people really appreciated it. It moved an awful lot of people also. It was a brilliant film. So thank you very much. You're the only one talking about this issue. And the next thing is, we've had a question from someone saying, how do we know that things are getting worse when so many people are saying that things are turning around?
Oh, well, let's just look at the statistics, the non-official statistics, the real statistics. The median household income in the United States is down 7.8% in just the last few years, and that's after adjusting for inflation. There's about 5.6 million less jobs than there were when the last recession began in 2007. Also, you have to look at the people who are no longer considered in the labor force, and that rose by 17.9 million between 2000 and 2011. Also, the unemployment rate, you have to look at the unemployment rate for the 20 to 29-year age bracket, and that has gone up substantially. It's over 13%. Also, back in 2000, more than 50% of all Americans as teenagers had a job. This past summer, it was only about 29%. And when Barack Obama entered the White House, the number of long-term unemployed workers in the United States was about 2.6 million. Today, it's at 5.6 million. And the average duration of unemployment today is three times as long as it was in the year 2000. And back in 1950, more than 80% of all men in the United States had jobs. Today, it's less than 65%. That's an enormous drop. So those are the things that are obvious that we can all measure. And also, in just 2 years ago, we had 30 million Americans on food stamps. Today, it's 48 million Americans on food stamps. And that's the most poverty-challenged. But then that's just people can't get enough food. And unfortunately, a lot of those people cannot afford healthy food, so they buy the cheaper and fattening and sick food. The federal housing assistance increased by 42% in the last 4 years. and we've had an increase in Medicare spending by 138%. So these are all real statistics. And all you have to do is then look at what's happening in our inner cities. The expanding ghettoization of the suburbs is increasing in almost every city. And the ghettoization of the urban area is increasing. So what you're having in the United States is you're having more isolated reservoirs, oases, a gated community, a high-end area economically that will be protected. And so all you have to do, it'd be like looking at global warming from a satellite, and you measure 20 years ago where the ice was and the glaciers were and measure today. And you go, wow, that glacier's gone back 30 miles. All that water's melted. Yes, and it's going to melt till there's just rock. Unless you're at the glacier or looking down on it, you wouldn't know that. When you're living in an area, rare is the person that goes out of their area, their protected area. They feel too uncomfortable. They want to stay where they have some boundaries of safety. So they don't connect with the rest of the world. They don't see the rest of the world. They don't see other people's pain because it's not they're not advocates for those people in the mainstream media. And hence, it's not a happy story. Unless it bleeds, it won't lead. If it doesn't have an advocate, it doesn't get attention. So we're far worse off than what those who are profiting off of our artificial enthusiasm for rebounding economy. They're doing fine. The rest of the world is not.
Right.
We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.
Okay, so your heart broke. You sit around moping, crying, crying. You say you even thinking about dying? Well, before you do anything rash, dig this.
Everybody plays a fool sometimes. There's no exception to